Green greetings and welcome to The Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, and I am very excited about today's program. I guess I probably always am, but especially so today. You're going to find out why in just a second. It has been a green letter week this past 7 days. We're going to be talking about some of the major events that I have been attending and talking about. That's everything from epic films like Chasing Ice to award ceremonies for Dr. Jim Hansen last night in San Francisco, as well as some other important events. Chris Mooney is the noted climate change writer, author, expert, and I think I can say climate advocate. He is joining me for the first time on the show. Also, in the first segment, we'll be chatting with Peter Sinclair of Climate Crocs, one of my favorite websites. If you don't know about it, you should. Very, very right on, political, humorous, always climate-centric content that Peter puts up there, I think, just about every day. And so both Chris and Peter will be joining me for this first half. And then in the second half, we're going to be talking to a novelist, actually a scientist who's written a novel about climate change. Dr. George Stewart will be talking about his new book called The Sleeper, Earth's Salvation. Of course, we don't have to go to fiction to look at the drama of climate change. All we need to do is look at the weather reports and tally up the damage from this epic year of extreme events from 2012. Of course, most recently, Hurricane Sandy. That and more has been top of mind, top of tongue, again, with all these events. Wanted, first of all, introduce Chris Mooney completely. He is someone whose work I've been covering. He's written for many, many magazines and journalistic publications, but most notably, he's written 4 books. I'm very impressed with that. I'm trying to get my first book out, and Chris has already written The Republican War on Science. That was back in 2005. In 2007, Storm World, Hurricanes, Politics, and the Battle Over Global Warming. In 2009, so I think you're on every other year track here, Chris, Unscientific America, and then most recently The Republican Brain from 2012 this year, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. And, of course, that's one of our favorite topics here on The Green Front. I'm sorry my co-host, D.R. Tucker, was not able to join us today, but we're still going to have a very scintillating conversation. So welcome to The Green Front, Chris and Peter.
I'm glad I could finally
make
it on.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
Great to have you both. I just was watching the Climate Desk event that you hosted yesterday, Chris, and we'll get to that in our conversation.
Great.
But I want to begin with Peter, who's been attending the American Geophysical Union event in San Francisco these last couple of days. And because of that gathering, there was quite a gathering at the San Francisco Commonwealth Club event last night to honor Dr. James Hansen getting the Stephen Schneider Climate Communications Award. He was there in spirit, for those who don't know, and he was a guest on my show, I'm proud to say, over the years. He was a Stanford climate researcher who tragically passed away in 2010, but his work and his wisdom and his humorous nature, his spirit very much alive in the room last night. But also on the panel, we had Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, who's been a guest on the show. We had Dr. Michael Mann, a friend of the Green Front, and a couple of other speakers as well. So really quite an impressive gathering, wasn't it, Peter?
Oh, wow. What a room. That was phenomenal. And I think you forgot the governor of California showed up.
Jerry Brown showed up in the audience and then came up to talk a little bit about cap and trade in California at the end of the event. He kind of snuck in at the end. Also, during the reception, I bumped right into Jim Balog, the amazing photographer behind Chasing Ice. Of course, we had the director and producer of that film, Jeff Orlowski, on the show last week, and we've been talking a lot about it. So it really was a who's who of the climate world and all in one place. So pretty powerful, sold-out crowd there, and the event went on for hours. It just had, you know, one panel, one award, one, you know, talk after another. But, Peter, tell us a little bit about the Geophysicists Union gathering. I know every year they come to San Francisco, and they, you know, talk about the latest research. Any highlights that stand out?
Well, this is, you may know, I believe it's the largest scientific gathering on the planet. Maybe Chris knows better, but about 20,000 scientists on the floor here, and presentations and of every description, but a lot about Arctic ice, permafrost, ocean warming, all of those different dynamics that go on to climate change. I've been talking to a number of scientists with a focus on anticipating the release in 2013 of the next round of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change studies, and talking about what's going to be in that report, what's not going to be in that report, and how best to kind of frame that as it comes out. One of the significant things that we're talking about is new research that is telling us that methane and carbon dioxide outgassing from the frozen permafrost up in Alaska, Canada, and Siberia seems to be moving along faster than what we had supposed not too long ago. And I spoke to Charles Miller, who's a NASA scientist with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who has been doing some of these more recent studies, as well as a young graduate student, Ben Hammond, from University of Alaska. And there's a tremendous amount of concern that this process is close to a tipping point, and there's a number of mechanisms which we haven't really thought too much about before that could accelerate it beyond even what we thought it was going to be, so that that output from melting permafrost could, by the end of the century, be a significant fraction of global greenhouse output, even if human beings manage to cut back drastically by that.
And, of course, while that was happening, they're talking about the climate in Doha and permafrost, melting permafrost, was also a big topic of discussion there. Chris, you had a fabulous climate desk event yesterday, I believe it was, roundtable with Ed Markey, our new hero of the climate movement. And he talked a little bit about how we may have this fiscal cliff, but even if we go over that, we could climb back from that. But the climate cliff we're approaching is an abyss that we may not be able to come back from, and he specifically mentioned what's happening with methane release and the tundra. That was a very interesting presentation, you know, from him. He may not be the most passionate speaker, but he really gets it, doesn't he?
Oh yeah, we were very impressed. He held the room in thrall, and I had a panel after him, so we were sort of there was no lack of ideas about things that can still be done to really make a dent in the problem. But I think that you know, Markey, he did explain that if you go off the climate cliff, you really can't get back in the same way. But I wouldn't say that he was non-optimistic, and I think that that was the theme that I took away from the event, was a sort of tempered rational optimism. And ultimately, people ended up with the feeling, you know, if President Obama decides to lead, there are tremendous amounts of things that he could do, and he wouldn't even have to have Congress necessarily going along with him, and all kinds of climate progress could be made, at least in the United States. And so that was what we really focused on a lot.
And the focus was, as it should be, on the impact of Hurricane Sandy, not only financially, you know, physically, many people are still suffering, but also politically, how that really might have brought about the shift that we need. What is your sense, you know, being back there in Washington, Chris? Are people still talking about the connection between Sandy and climate change, or did that, you know, fade with the headlines? Do you sense some optimism?
Well, Congressman Markey, again, he hit that theme very strongly. He had a great soundbite. He said that, you know, if you're a Republican north of the Mason-Dixon line, you can no longer make jokes about global warming because of Sandy. That's what he said. So I think that he felt that it had changed the dynamic. But, you know, I think, again, there was sort of tempered optimism. The administration, despite the fact you could argue that it was sort of the October surprise in the election, I don't think that since the election, the administration has done much to seize upon it. And one of our other panelists, Eric Cooley, he's wrote the great book, The Climate War, pointed out that when given the opportunity in press conferences and such to talk about Sandy and climate change, President Obama, White House press secretary Jay Carney, has failed entirely to link global warming to Sandy in a way that's completely scientifically accurate, right? You know, and they've repeated this old mantra that, you know, you can't attribute any event to climate change, whereas, of course, we know that climate change was part of the impact of the storm, and, you know, you can say that quite definitively with respect to sea level rise. The more water thrown on the land than there would have been otherwise, it's really, really simple. And so President Obama is not apparently up to date on what we know. And so that's kind of disconcerting. I know he has many, many other things on his mind, but that was what ended up being the theme of the event, was that it's all about how engaged and active the president wants to be.
Well, and that also is partly a function of the media, mainstream media, even though this is now kind of old news, but I think it's worth, since you have written books on the Republican mind and trying to understand it, you know, the influence of conservatives and right-wing Republicans and libertarians apparently in, you know, affecting the lack of climate change in any of the debates or really in the election, you know, altogether. Of course, having a candidate like Romney who was mocking Obama for daring to care about the rising seas, that's as a hurricane was bearing down on the very city where they were having a convention a day late. You know, how surprised were you that it didn't come up in conversation, or perhaps given your area of focus, not surprised at all?
Well, I became increasingly shrill about this as the campaign went on. You know, I think that there's two things going on. I mean, there's the psychology of conservatism, how they handle this stuff, which is, you know, this really kind of, among many on the right, this really kind of rigid denial that's partly influenced by, you know, their sense that they have to be completely loyal team members to fellow Republicans, and part of the team, part of the ritual they go through is denying global warming exists. You know, and also, you know, I think just a sort of authoritarian mindset. But that's not what's going on with the press. The press is something else. The press is just sort of like lack of depth and general superficiality.
I could not agree more, by the way. We talk about that a lot on this show. Just appalled at the, pardon the expression, gangbang mentality of covering, you know, the top two or three stories, usually, you know, political stories, spinning it to death and ignoring, you know, the melting planet.
Yeah, it's staggering, you know. And one of the big punchlines out of the election, not directly related to climate change, was essentially that pundits are fools because they don't know anything about polling and data. And you know, WizKid, the New York Times, Nate Silver, though he wasn't the only one, was actually able to assess the state of the race. But no talking heads, but many talking heads apparently were not able to figure out that Obama was going to win. And it's just a classic example of so many people on television that we anoint as having some kind of authority, not knowing how to think about information. And so when you then throw them information about climate science, do you really expect them to do any better? And the answer is no.
No.
So, in that sense,
you're right. It was not surprising. And yet, you know, as, you know, we've just seen such incredible extreme weather events this year, you would have thought, and Candy Crowley teased us by saying she wanted to ask that question for all those climate people out there, but just didn't have time. It reminded me of Bob Schieffer 4 years ago during the one of the debates. He said the same thing when asked, why didn't you ask about climate change? He said, well, there were just so many questions to get to. You know, it has just for too long come at the bottom of anybody's mainstream media's priority list.
They're like a low-information voter. I mean, basically, they're like a weather vane. And that's how much of the public is on climate change, too. We just expect better of our journalists, right? But essentially, you know, if it's thrown in front of them because a hurricane is thrown at the city they live in, then wow, they'll be like, oh, running around for a couple of days and actually interested in it. Just like when members of the public experience weird weather, they become very receptive, we know, to accepting climate change, and then it'll vanish just as quickly. And so I do fear that the Sandy moment won't lead to as much waking up as it really probably should have.
And it's not just reporters and correspondents. We do talk about this a lot on the show, so forgive me, regular listeners, but I'm sure, Chris, you'll agree, if you're not aware, it's also the fault of the, you know, gatekeepers, the managers, the executives, the programmers. I've been trying for years to get a show on mainstream radio, and I'm told there's no way. You know, we've got 95% of talk shows dominated by conservatives. No friendly environment for a program on the environment, even if it is, you know, more practical than political, or even if you want to make it controversial. And I'm talking, you know, at the radio and television level, syndicators just don't seem to think that this is something of interest to Americans that could possibly be, you know, popular and really find its following, even though there's no such, you know, fare anywhere else. And, you know, God forbid could even be profitable, since we do have, you know, car companies that are trying to generate, you know, demand and interest in their electric cars, as well as solar companies that are, you know, looking at a national, you know, customer base. So I put fault there, too. I just had to mention that, as I often do, because not many people would know, because they haven't had the privilege of badgering mainstream media programmers like I have for the last 10 years.
Well, you'll get an argument from me about that. I mean, conservative radio has had an advantage because, among other things, conservatives are so darn decisive and sure of themselves that it makes for good radio because they're able to make, this is the psychology of conservatism, they're able to make sort of extreme blanket statements that get everybody real riled up, and liberals are all nuanced, and we have to be kind of like, you know, accurate. And it makes for sometimes more troubling, difficult radio. So I mean, that's the inherent problem with science and environmental programming. But if you have an art to it, you know, and I know that you do, there are ways to make it very entertaining. And so you know, the marketing people are going to be right until they're wrong, and they're so good at not seeing the next big thing coming.
Oh, God, hear, hear. And then if they do, finally, they will claim all the credit. Well, they saw it coming all along, you know. No, you didn't, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, we haven't even talked about the influence of money. I mean, the fossil fuel industry and the coal and the gas and the oil commercials all throughout the you know, debates and elections, especially on CNN and even MSNBC, it's really speaking volumes about why we're stuck where we are. And somehow the liberal and progressive media doesn't put the same resources behind the kind of programming that we really need to get out there, including, you know, the first green climate focus show.
Well, I'd like to see it. I want to say that, you know, in the quote mainstream media, Chris Hayes at MSNBC really does care about climate and really does do it well when he does it. So, you know,
oh, absolutely. We've given him kudos and been actually emailing him. I emailed him just this morning. He's actually trying to get Phil Griffin, the head of MSNBC, to be interested in such a show because DR and I have been watching very closely, very pleased to see how, you know, much of an advocate he's been. And there are other programs on that network and Current TV who they've been doing segments on climate change. I guess what we're trying to push for is, you know, a supported show in mainstream that focuses on the solutions, what we're going to do about it. Because now that we know we have a problem, and getting experts on to say it's here is the first step. But, you know, places like here where we have been talking for years, more than a decade in my case, you know, with people who are on the front lines, who are actually talking about what needs to happen, they need a much wider audience. They deserve to be heard by more Americans. I'm sure you agree. Peter? Peter, want to chime in here?
Say again?
Just want to chime in here with some thoughts. We've had this kind of conversation before, but you're at the forefront.
You were talking about Hurricane Sandy, which I think is kind of a, well, obviously a good, I hate to say good news, bad news, but in a way, a good news in terms of raising awareness for the wider world. And what's striking to me is how many scientists I have talked to in recent months that have used words like new climate state, a new normal, a new equilibrium of things. And this is significant because up until a few years ago, one of the concerns was that climate change was going to really hit the developing world extremely hard, but that more developed nations in the temperate zones might be spared some of the worst effects until it was really too late for them to, you know, realize how much this was going to affect them. But what has been happening over the last 3 years, if you haven't noticed, is a series of just one walloping extreme event after another, both in the United States, in Europe, and Asia. Whether it's droughts or exceptional storms or rains or floods, it just seemed to be coming one after another. And more scientists are connecting the dots between these events and a destabilization of the jet stream, or a new equilibrium of the jet stream brought about by the loss of Arctic ice. And if this is the case, if these conjectures turn out to be true, then we in the temperate zone can expect a continuing series of these really hammer blows, like this year's drought, the very unusual spring that caused so many crop disruptions, and even more storms like Sandy. So good news is that maybe we're going to wake up a little bit sooner than some people feared. Bad news is it's because we may get hammered really a lot harder than what anybody thought.
And the latest research shows that our carbon emissions are still growing, and that it looks like if we don't do something pretty quickly, pretty drastically, pretty much across the board, we cannot stop, warming of 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, and we still have people without power, from Sandy. We saw 8 million homes and businesses losing power. Just today, there's word of hundreds of people dying from a typhoon in the Philippines. It seems to be that Mother Nature is truly trying to send us a message, and the question is, will we, wake up in time? And, Chris, I'm wondering if you think that we will be able to bridge that political chasm to avoid the climate cliff. And, we hear so much about the debt, and what about the ecological debt we're, just laying on, next generations?
I think that, if President Obama does really decide to make this part of his legacy, then everything that I'm hearing from people who have more expertise than me in the regulatory process and the political process suggests that he can kind of just ignore Republicans on this one and, fire up the Environmental Protection Agency. And if it does what it pretty much is legally now required and also legally empowered to do, it can regulate coal-fired power plants, and it can take quite a chunk out of U.S. emissions. So, without saying that that will completely fix the problem of our emissions, and certainly without saying that there's anything about China's emissions, which, are now the biggest, there is some ground for thinking that the United States is not going to be such a laggard anymore in this, mm-hmm. at least. And that's,
Well, we certainly, contribute more than our share of per capita emissions. And what you're talking about, of course, would be the EPA acting under the Clean Air Act. That's one thing that needs to happen. Of course, we need to see Obama stop Keystone. We also need to stop the 100-year-old tax breaks, the subsidies for oil companies. And last night, Peter will recall, because you could not miss it, not once, not twice, not three times, but I would say perhaps almost 10 times, Jim Hansen said we need a carbon tax. Every time there was a question, it sort of came down to that answer.
Yeah, we need a cap on carbon. It's worth noting that emissions in the United States are somewhat down. Maybe Chris will confirm. I think we peaked in around 2007, 2008. So, there's reason to be hopeful, even with the limited efforts that we've got so far. We're making some progress. But also, conversations I've had with people who are well-connected in the Republican Party tell me that a lot of these people are looking at the polls, and they kind of get it that they're in trouble on this issue. They're really tied up by this extreme base that they've got that really dominates their primary process and keeps a lot of people from getting to the front of the line. But the willingness that we've seen more recently for some Republican legislators to disavow this tax pledge that they've all been bound up by over recent years indicates maybe a little bit renewed courage on their part, because they know going forward that if they don't get the climate issue straight and a few of the other social issues that they're way off base on, they're just not going to win any more elections in this country. And I think that was brought home to them this fall.
And by the way, when I said emissions are up, that was from research coming from the Global Carbon Project on Monday
That's
of
correct.
This week, showing that emissions from industry rose about 2.6% even in a weak global economy, but they did credit China and India for most of that growth.
That's
yeah,
correct.
And just, there's modeling from resources from the future, resources for the future, sorry, and they say that we can get to Obama's Copenhagen goal of roughly 70% reductions by 2020, lower than they were in. So,
17%, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Sorry about that. And
yeah.
I just want to say that clearly does depend on, taking a real whack at coal by the EPA. And I just want to say one important aspect of the evolving policy story is this growing potential tension between the EPA doing things and Congress maybe someday doing things. And what's happening is that, you know, Congress did nothing ever, but especially in the last 4 years, and so EPA went ahead and did things. And that was always going to be the story if Congress didn't act. And now EPA has gone and done a lot already, although the biggest thing still remains to be done, power plants. But it already has, you know, done a lot for fuel economy standards. And so it's really important that if Republicans are ever ready to have something like a carbon tax, that this not be allowed to preempt what EPA does, because you know that's what they're going to want. You know that they're going to want to say, okay, we'll put a price on carbon, but only if EPA knocks off all of this regulation. So that, right. You know, that's going to be a really not acceptable outcome, I think, once EPA has made all the progress that it's set to make. So when that happens, I think we need to be very mindful. And I asked Ed Markey this question yesterday, and he said he would view any deal that sought to hobble EPA with, as he put it, an arched eyebrow, which I like the expression.
And the panelists last night, albeit prompted by a question from me, did feel that, yes, there is a role for, you know, media to play in helping to educate the public, because it still feels, I don't care what anybody says, that, you know, we're still talking about, you know, 350 parts per million, almost 400, and Bill McKibben, you know, in the climate and activists and progressive circles mostly, and that most of my friends, non-green friends, have no idea about those numbers, and it just seems like we need some massive, you know, emergency education, you know, project to really get more Americans on board, and that will make everything easier, from legislation. I think we need President Obama to give a State of the Climate Address. You probably would like to see that too, both of you, to really show the emergency that we're facing.
We will cross 400 very soon. Go ahead. Yeah,
there's no question that media has to get better, and we're not entirely powerless in moving that forward. Just Chris knows that over the last 3 years, there have been an enormous rise in the communication between scientists in the field and people like himself, communicators, people who are adept in the media. And this has made an enormous difference in how the climate story is getting out to the public. And we've been able to tamp down some of these disinformation initiatives almost before they got started. There's several examples of that I could probably reel through. But in as much as we often feel like we're powerless, but we're not entirely powerless. I'll give you an example. About 6 months ago, you remember the Heartland Institute put up this goofy billboard of the Unabomber and comparing the Unabomber to people that understand the science of climate change. And John Abraham, who's a scientist at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, is one of the real leaders in this area, got a call at 3 a.m., not a call, an email at 3 a.m. in the morning from Leo Hickman in the UK, saying, hey, what are you going to do about this billboard? Of course, none of us had woken up yet, very soon John had that out into a number of lists, and by maybe 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, there were already a half a dozen blog posts that were framing this thing in as ridiculous a light as it deserved. So that actually turned into a huge fiasco for the Heartland Institute and lost dozens of companies that had been funding them due to the very effective public outcry that was organized by Forecast the Facts and a number of other climate organizations. So this is a powerful interconnectivity and talking to each other, social networking and people power. They are examples of a very real kind of soft power that people have. And so don't underestimate what we can do both defensively and offensively in this score.
I couldn't agree more, and I don't mean to be negative. I just want to hear it in more of my mainstream circles and you know, more of mainstream America, middle America, talking about these things. We're very involved, and we follow all this very closely, but I just am constantly appalled at how many people don't, and that's what I think needs to change. Chris, closing thoughts?
Well, you know, I think my closing theme is sort of rational optimism. You know, I mean, there's a huge amount of bad news if you look at all of the statistics for the climate. And we know that. But at the same time, you know, this is a moment where there are people really waking up, including people that have never really taken the issue seriously before. They just can't ignore the evidence right before their eyes that this is not the weather that they grew up with. And that is really making an impact on people across the country. And if this winter goes the way it's starting to go, with 70 in D.C. yesterday and the day before, that's going to continue to happen. And, you know, there is a huge amount that in the U.S. especially can be done without even any legislative fights. So, you know, we haven't completely wrecked the planet yet.
Let's hope we don't wait till it's too late, but sometimes it seems like that's exactly what we're doing. Thanks so much, Chris Mooney. It was worth the wait to get you on. Really appreciate it. Hope you'll come back on
the
show.
Nice to be on.
Peter Sinclair, thanks for all your great work, and we'll have you on again as well. I'm sorry to say we have a caller, but we have to move on to our next guest. So call back next time, caller. We'd love to talk to you. We'll be right back. It sure is. Welcome.